السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. It is your sister and friend Adar, and you're listening to the Digital Sisterhood Podcast. Boy, do I have a story for you. First, I want to preface this by saying I could have been Sherlock Holmes' sidekick, okay? My investigation skills are actually top tier. Somebody needs to tell BBC News that your girl is a natural, okay? But before I get ahead of myself, let me tell you how Sophia, our unofficial casting podcast director, planted a seed in my head this time last year, okay? It was around the time when we were casting stories for season 2, and Sophia calls and says, "Yo, I heard the craziest rumor." And I'm already, you know, in the ear like, "What? What's the rumor? What's the tea?" And she says, "Listen, I heard a story about Sahara International." And if you don't know what Sahara International is, it is one of the most popular and published translations of the Quran. Matter of fact, it was that translation that gave me an incredible introduction to the Quran and its meaning. It was also the translation that inspired me to study Arabic today. It was my personal go-to and preferred translation. And probably yours too. Go look up www.quran.com or check the translation of your current kitab. There's probably a high chance that it was translated by Sahara International. Nonetheless, if you look up the Quran on the internet, you'll also see the Sahara International is also one of the listed options of translations next to the notable ones like Yusuf Ali, Dr. Mustafa Kitab, Mohammed Pickle, and many more. But let me tell you what the rumor was, okay? The rumor was, according to Sophia, was that Sahara International was actually, wait for it, a penmanship name for three revert white American women. I repeat, three white revert American women. Listen, I couldn't believe it. I literally thought Sophia, I said, "Sophia, where are you getting these stories from? I'm pretty sure that's not the case. I don't know why I always just assumed that these translations were written by men, but to hear they're written by women and like they're American women, they're white American. I just could not believe it, to be honest. It just seemed like a little far-fetched." But you know what? Sophia really encouraged me to dig deep. She's like, "You know what? Go just do your research, see if it is true. You might be surprised. And you might have the best story on your hands." So I was like, "Yeah, you know, maybe, you know, I can get in my investigative bag, you know what I'm saying? I could do a little research, one or two." So I did. So I went on Google, chill Google, because you know chill Google never fails me. Okay, I start Googling international women, international Muslim women, international Reaver white Muslim women. And then eventually something came up. And I look it up and I see that there was an interview about them. I read a little bit about it. And then I recognized there was a name there because most of the three names that I had seen, two of the names I had seen were Kunya's, but the third name was a full name. And it said Amatullah Bentley. I was like, "Amatullah Bentley." I copy pasted. I'm like, "Okay, cool. I got her name." I went to LinkedIn because you know, you go and find everybody in LinkedIn. So I put her in LinkedIn. I wrote Amatullah Bentley. First of all, I love her last name, Bentley. And I was just waiting to see if she'd come up. And lo and behold, Amatullah Bentley comes up. You see this really nice woman, this really charming smile. Okay, with this really wrapped around hijab, looks like the nicest lady in the world. Probably somebody I've seen before. Maybe my neighbor who gives me cookies every now and then. But I was like, "Oh my God, she seems like such a sweet woman." So I clicked it just to make sure it was her. When I clicked on LinkedIn, I could tell she hadn't been on it for a very long time. I went to her employment section and I saw it. It said CEO of Sahara International. And I gasped. I was like, "What? This is real? Is she really a woman?" Wait, obviously she's a woman, but did she really do this? Is Sophia right? Are the rumors true? I couldn't believe my eyes. And so I started to dig deeper. And I noticed that she also had some other interesting stuff on there as well, which we could talk about a bit later. But I was like, "Yo, I need to find out more." And so what I did is I messaged her on LinkedIn, confident, thinking I'm going to get a response one or two days. I didn't hear from her for a whole month. At this point, I'm like, is there any way other I can find her? So what I do, I check Instagram, I check Facebook. She is not coming up anywhere. I'm like, is this person even real? Is this account even real? Have I lost my mind? You know what I'm saying? I'm just thinking, this is not adding up. She is nowhere to be found. nowhere else. Just this LinkedIn page that seems like she hasn't logged in since probably 2006. I don't know. I don't even know when LinkedIn was created, to be honest. But probably the first day it was created, she never went back on because I could not get a hold of her. It made me really sad because I was like, I have this really intense feeling. There's an incredible story here. But I just was like, how am I going to find a story? This is probably going to be the story of the year, man. What the heck? Like, I was just so frustrated. And then, obviously, I had to continue with business. And so season two was on its way. I'd interviewed Ustad Mari Mamir, if you guys remember from season two. And something, at the end of her interview, something told me, yo, what are the odds are that maybe Ustad Mari knows Amitala Bentley? Maybe, you know, she knows Dr. Haifa Yunus, who actually did speak to her, that I seen the interview on YouTube. I was like, maybe she can get, you know, her email from her. I don't know. I'm just trying to connect dots here, bro. I'm just trying to connect dots. I'm trying to go back to Sophia saying, I caught her, I found her, period, per, I'm investigating, you know, champion of the year. I'm just trying to get all these labels. But like, I was like, let me just ask her. And so after the interview was done, I just say that Stan Money and me, lost our time, bless her and me. I was like, hey, have you heard of this woman named Amitala Bentley, the CEO of Sihir International? She's like, yes, I do. I did hear a few things about her. I'm like, man, everybody knows about her but me. And she's like, yeah. She's like, I think Dr. you know, Haifa might know, have her contact information. This and the third, let me ask her. I said, Ustada, if you get her number or email, I will make the biggest dua I've ever made for anybody in my entire life. Obviously, that was a very, you know, bold statement. And Stan Money was like, oh, okay, no problem. I'm going to make you good for it. And so 4 days later, I get an email, boom. And it's Stan Money saying, I'm ready for that dua now. And I'm like, what? And it's something like, I just scroll down and I see Amitala Bentley's email. I literally start cheering in my bedroom, shimmy shaking, shoulder shaking, all that. And I was just like, oh my God, I got her email. I call Sophia. I'm like, Sophia, I got her email. She goes, no way. I said, yeah, I'm going to get her email. I'm going to talk to her right now. I'm going to just charm her and just tell her about this podcast and just ask her if she's going to come on and tell her story. She's like, okay, bet. So I email Amitala Bentley. I write a really nice email. I tell her how much, like, I'm excited to talk to her, how I heard about this, that, and the third, that, you know, she potentially did something really great and I really would like her backstory, this, that, and the third, the podcast, blah, blah, blah. And then a few days later, well, to be exact, 97 hours and 22 minutes, give or take, she responds to me and she writes, and I quote, Wa alaikum salam. How did you get my work email? I was mortified. Now, I don't know what I was expecting in response, but she sounded upset and I was upset that she was upset. I was panicking. I was like, oh my God, she's never going to trust us with her story. Why did I email from her work email? Am I a weirdo? Why did I track her down like she's some sort of like, why did I do that? Why did I move like a creep like that? I was panicking. I was literally panicking. I was like, oh my God, that's it. I lost my shot. Khalas yani. Like, that is so embarrassing. Oh my God. What do I say? I don't even know what to say. Anyways, after a few more apologies, a video call, and probably a really long apology, she trusted us enough to sit down with us and tell us her story in a way that she had never done before.
Well, thank you, sister. First of all, my apologies if I came off curt when I answered your email. I was just like, how did somebody get my email? I didn't even realize that when I had spoken with Dr. Yusuf Dr. Haifa, that I had even used my work email. I was probably just in a rush and, you know, forgot to change it to my personal one. And, you know, we had somebody interview us a long time ago. That turned out to kind of twist things. Mm. And so we were always very apprehensive of doing interviews. And you also have to remember where we were at and what we were doing at the time. So the three of us, Mohammed Asami, Mary Kennedy, and myself, who make up Sahih International, we were all living in Jeddah at the time and working. This was in the late 80s, early 90s. And you have to think the society there at that time was still very divided about women being on the forefront, and especially because we were foreigners, we weren't Saudi. And so we felt that there may be resistance, like who are these women and why do they think that they can do this project? And that's why we always just used our company name, Sahi International, in the beginning, and then never even introduced anything about ourselves.
You know how I mentioned that AJ was just too hard to find? Well, there was a reason for that. There was a disturbing and completely biased interview of them that was published by the Daily Mail back in 2017. In the article, it completely took their words out of context and started off the piece with saying, and I quote, "Three American women who converted to Islam moved to Saudi Arabia and founded a publishing company who had inadvertently created the most popular translation of the Quran for ISIS terrorists, which was wildly biased and Islamophobic." After the article, AJ, Mohammed, and Mary Kennedy decided they weren't going to talk to the media again, which explained why finding AJ felt like she didn't want to be found, because she didn't. But before we get into this, let's take it back to the beginning of AJ's story to get the full picture.
So I was born in Rochester, Minnesota. I'm the fifth of five children. My sister and brothers were, those four were all born within 4 years. And then there was a gap, and then me. So I actually grew up very different than my siblings. My siblings, you know, played sports and had paper routes and went camping and fishing and all that stuff. They were very much a family unit. And then by the time I was in kindergarten, my mom decided to go to college. She had never been to college, and she became a nurse. So I ended up really kind of being a latchkey kid. I spent a lot of time alone. I lived in a neighborhood where we had a lot of elderly people or very young couples with babies. There weren't a lot of kids in my neighborhood. So I guess I was one of those kids that had big imagination because I had to, because I was alone a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, I had my pretend friends and my baby dolls. And, you know, as I got older, took a lot of bike rides or went down to the river and threw rocks or, you know, I was kind of a loner just because of circumstances. Mm-hmm. I went to Catholic school my whole life, but I remember, even as young as about fourth grade, I just had too many questions, and a lot of questions weren't welcome in school. You know, when you were questioning faith, I believe it's about fourth grade when you start going to confession. And I remember feeling like, oh, you know, you have to have sins. There's something you have to tell the priest. And I remember lying in the confessional, like saying that I had talked back to my mom or lied to her or whatever, because they made you feel like you were so. And I remember thinking to myself, it didn't matter what I said in that confessional to the priest, but his answer was, the penitence, you know, was, you know, say 10 Hail Marys and 10 Our Fathers and promise not to do it again. And as a child, I remember thinking, so no matter what I come in here and say that I did, that's all I have to do. It didn't even make sense logically in a justice type of way. And I thought, who are you? You're a human being and you're not talking to God. I know that. I know you are not talking to God right now and Him telling you what I need to do in order to be forgiven. So I would say that I became an atheist at a very young age because I just never believed in what the church taught me. I always had a sense of justice and doing right and being good to people and, you know, being honest and, you know, just an ethical sense. I think that growing up in Christianity taught me that. But I guess I had more of this kind of Mother Earth. I didn't necessarily believe there was a heaven or a hell. As I got older, as a teenager, I really struggled with God. I got into some trouble. I was a little bit of a rebel. I remember saying to a friend, like, oh my God, what am I going to do in this situation? And she said, talk to God. And I said, God, there is no God. If there was a God, there wouldn't be war and poverty and disease and devastation and all these negative things that exist in life. I couldn't understand how you could say that there was a loving God with negative things. So I was very kind of hardcore in my disbelief, actually. But then when I got to college, I met a lot of mostly Arab students who were here studying. And I'm going to be frank, they were not practicing Muslims. They were going to the bars, they had girlfriends, they were living the dunya, right? But there was something about them that was different than most of like the American guys I knew. There was still that what they had grown up with had been taught in being generous and sincere and kind. And, you know, they still had like Islamic principles, but they just weren't living, they weren't practicing, you know, the rituals of prayer and fasting and all of that. I also didn't understand, you know, Islam wasn't really much of a conversation, but it did come up a few times in kind of very awkward ways. And I guess my curiosity got sparked because I had this traditional view that a lot of us here had just from what we saw in the movies, that women were second class, you know, just really negative ideas about Islam. But I guess by then, being 18 or 19, I guess I knew enough to try to be fair to find out what's the reality. Not initially. Initially, I said, you're crazy if you think I'm going to live like that. Mm-hmm. When someone first suggested you should learn about Islam, I go, no, thank you. But I really, I guess I knew deep down that that's not fair either because I really don't know anything. Mm-hmm. And so there was a Muslim sister in the group who, again, wasn't practicing, but she is actually the one who said, if you want to learn about Islam, you're not going to learn about it from us. Let me take you to the masjid.
Wow.
And yeah, subhanAllah. And so when she took me to the masjid, the brother there was like, you know, how can we help you? And I said, well, I'd really like to meet Muslim women, meaning practicing Muslim women, because I don't know any and I want to hear it from their perspective. Mm-hmm. And so he gave me the phone number to a sister, and then she happened to tell me about a halaqa, you know, that they had weekly, and invited me to the home of the woman where the halaqa was taking place. And this, now remember, I really knew nothing about true Islam. And it came time for Salah, and somebody put it, you got to remember, guys, I'm older, mm-hmm. right? This is back in the day, we didn't have internet. We, you know, we had like little cassette tape machines, and somebody put in a cassette for the adhan,
wow.
for prayer time. And when I heard it, I started crying, and I don't know why.
Allah
and one of the women said to me, you're a Muslim and you just don't know it. And that was the weirdest thing that anybody had ever said to me in my life. But I was so emotionally touched by it. And for me, I guess I just go back now and say, this is the fitrah. Mm. This is, you know, this is the natural instinct. This is the natural, we know inside of us that God exists no matter how much we want to deny it. And this was him just kind of tapping me going, hello, wake up. You know, it's right here in front of you. Mm-hmm. You just need to embrace it. And so one of the sisters at that halaqa really took me under her wing and just sat me down and taught me everything.
Wow.
She sat me down with hadith books. Like, you know, for some people, picking up a Quran or a translation is what guides them to Islam. But because I wasn't spiritual or really, you know, it just seemed too much almost like reading the old Bible stories in the beginning, right? I tried to find that close connection, but I didn't. I'm just being honest, this is my path. But when she sat me down and we would read the hadith, and I got more first into the etiquettes and the just some of the amazing things we know in history that happened that are mentioned in the hadith or whatnot, those things really is what grabbed my heart. And I just remember there's sometimes like the hadith about how when you talk about Allah, how the angels surround you all the way up to the heavens, and it's almost like you would feel like you felt so blessed in those conversations, right? Because I studied so deeply. Her name happened to be Amatullah too. And that's actually why I chose the name Amatullah, because she was such, you know, of course it's through Allah. Mm. It's Allah, right? But she's the person who taught me my deen. And I love her more than, you know, probably any other sister on the face of this earth.
Mashallah.
And I just wanted her name. So yeah, that's why I chose Antoine.
Oh my God, why am I getting emotional? Sorry. I need a tissue box. That is probably the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. In college, AJ met a foreign student from Saudi Arabia on campus. Although at the time, there was nothing between them. Things, though, quickly changed when she became a Muslim. As soon as he heard, he called her up, boldly asked her for her hand in marriage, and AJ said yes. AJ was having a whirlwind of romance, the biggest romance of her life, with her Saudi prince. But things got quickly too real. AJ, at 20 years old, now had to prepare to move to Saudi Arabia for good. Thankfully, AJ gets an opportunity to be introduced to a sister from the U.S. that was also living in Saudi that she could connect with. That must have been a big transition, though, going from the Twin Cities to Saudi Arabia at that time.
You know, the thing is, you got to remember, the human brain is not fully developed until you're 26, okay? No offense to you youngins, but, you know,
it's 19... It's science. It's fact. Our frontal lobe has not developed at that time. No, absolutely.
It's fact.
It's fact.
So I'm 19 years old, or maybe I had just turned 20.
No, you're a baby.
And, you know, I mean, the world was out there for the taking. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I hate the word naive. I hate to think of myself as naive, because I always felt that I was so mature and blah, blah, blah. But really, no, I was probably, you know, maybe a little naive. And I just went with the flow. I'm like, oh, I'm a Muslim. Here's a Muslim. Okay, you know, like, it's fine. Let's just go for it. And that's what I did. But honestly, I went to Saudi Arabia with Umm Muhammad's phone number. So the sister, like, look at how Allah works. So when I went to the masjid and the brother asked, you know, and I said, I want to meet a Muslim woman. So the first sister that he introduced me to, her mother-in-law, lived in Syria. And Umm Muhammad used to live in Syria because her husband's Syrian. Mm. So these two American women, you know, our elders, knew each other there.
Oh, wow.
So my friend had the phone number to Umm Muhammad. So when I went to Jeddah, I had her phone number. But of course, I had no idea who she was.
AJ didn't get the number of no regular person. She was given the number of Umm Muhammad, a revered Muslim who mastered the Arabic language while studying in Damascus, Syria. Believe it or not, at the time she was studying in Syria, Umm Muhammad was known as Emily Sami, and she wasn't even a Muslim then. In an interview, she famously said, "It took me quite a long time to embrace Islam. I'd given up on any kind of religion before that, and I went to live in Syria because my husband's Syrian. And there I found that Islam was more of a tradition than it was a commitment. People couldn't really answer the questions I had, so I realized that I would have to learn how to read Arabic to know what the Muslim scholars were saying. And that took me a long time." But they didn't stop Umm Muhammad. When Syria finally opened a 2-year extensive course at Damascus University, she joined it. And from there, she went on with the aid of a dictionary, a grammar book, and a simple tafsir. She just sort of struggled along on her own until she felt she was ready. Unfortunately, at the time, it was not easy to become a Muslim in Syria. They would make you meet a priest who'd come specifically to talk you out of converting to Islam. So she thought she would have to study a lot more to be able to answer what the priest was going to say. And that took a bit longer. But alhamdulillah, the priest failed in his effort to dissuade her. And finally, after 12 years, Emily Sami, now known as Umm Muhammad, went to court and took her shahada. And after that, she began her journey in seeking knowledge as a Muslim.
We need to remember that in the days of the Prophet Islam and the Sahaba and the Tabi'een and all the generations that came after them, how did they learn? They learned in study circles. They didn't have universities at that time. So even though Umm Muhammad didn't have an official degree from a university, she studied, and she studied in circles like that, right? And she studied from the great early scholars and also more modern scholars as well. But when it comes to meanings in the Quran, you have to go back to what those early scholars said.
Absolutely.
So you don't necessarily, as long as you have the language and the understanding, right, And she had been teaching tafsir and fiqh in an Islamic education center for foreigners for there for many years. So just when it comes to the credibility, we need to remember that in Islamic circles, this is how education was often passed on. And that although Amatullah had given me a very firm foundation, the depth at which we studied with Muhammad was, really into the balagha. I love balagha, which I never can think of how to say that in English. But like when you get into the meanings of the grammar and how the words are interrelated, and you just can comprehend so much more in Arabic when you get into the balagha, right? And so we studied that, and I just loved getting in depth with the fiqh. Like I learned so much in my studies with her.
When AJ moved to Saudi, she began to learn from Muhammad in her home. And AJ was so enthralled with learning from her, so much so, it sparked AJ's thirst for knowledge and desire to share that knowledge with others. Now, the second part of that, however, only became more clear on how she was going to do that after the tragic passing of her friend's husband, Abu Bilal.
So there was a Canadian brother who, him and his wife, who's from Fiji, they both studied at Umm al-Qura University in Mecca. Okay, they were graduates and they did have their degrees in Islamic studies. So, subhanAllah, his Abu Bilal, he, you know, went to lead Fajr prayer one day. His habit was to come home, go to his sitting room and read. And subhanAllah, he didn't come out of the room for quite some time, and his wife found that he had had a heart attack and passed away. Yeah, and they had five small children, and here she's a foreigner in the country, and what was she going to do? So anyway, a group of us had decided that during her Iddah, you know, we would support the family. We all put in our, you know, 10, 20, 50 bucks, whatever, every month. And, you know, until she could get out of her Iddah and find a job and figure it all out. Well, they kind of lived on the outskirts of Jeddah, between Jeddah and Mecca. And it kind of became my job to take the money that was collected every month out to her home. So one month when I was taking the money out there, it just so happened that our car was in the shop. And so my husband at the time had borrowed a friend's car. And when I went, she said, you know, my husband had made an agreement with Darul Bulqasim to publish this book. Can you take the manuscript? Can you drop it off for me? And I said, oh, sure, no problem. But because we're using somebody else's car today, do you mind if I do it when we get our car back? And she said, oh, no problem. So look at how Allah works. You know, this is really Allah's plan. I just said, do you mind if I read it? She said, oh, no, go ahead. So this was a translation of, I think it's Ibn al-Qayyim's book on the nafs and the ruh, on, you know, the soul, and what happens to it at the time of death and after death and yada, yada, yada. Now, this was one subject that I hadn't delved into yet as a Muslim. And I was just enthralled reading that book. However, with all due respect, having been speaking classical Arabic for so long, studying and living in Saudi Arabia, Abu Bilal's English sounded very flowery, like Arabic. Okay? And kind of in Arabic, there's no punctuation, right? You can go on and on and on and on and on. And so that's kind of how the sentence structure and whatnot was happening in the English translation. And I just thought to myself, this is such a good book, but it needs work, you know, from the English side. So I called, his wife, and I said, you know, I have a friend, Mary, who's an English editor, and I think we could really kind of, you know, do a little more justice to this work. you know, it's too good not to do that. And she said, no, there's other people who have looked at it. They all said it's good. And I just had this sinking gut, like in your bones feeling that I have to convince her. So I called her back and I said, you know what, maybe if I brought you some examples, I really think you would agree with me. You know, let's really do justice to this book. And it just needs some editing, right? So alhamdulillah, you know, she agreed. And we talked to the publisher, And he said, yeah, yeah, that's fine. Go ahead, you know, make the changes. Well, in reality, we did a lot of changes, just kind of in not to do any injustice to what he did, but we kind of restructured things. Mm-hmm. And there were times that Mary and I, again, not being fluent, either one of us in Arabic, we kind of struggled sometimes with the hadith, like, oh, I think he means this, but we don't want to edit it when we could be getting the wrong meaning. Mm-hmm. And that's when we pulled in Umm Muhammad and said, will you please check the ayahs? Will you please check the hadith and make sure that the translation, like the edits that we're making to make it sound better, are really the meaning. We, you know, that is the crucial, right? So that's how it all started. We did the first book, we took it back to the publisher, and we had all this read and rearrange and blah, blah, blah. And he said, oh, I didn't think you were going to make that many changes. He said, if you want to restructure it, then you need to bring it back to me press ready. And I just said, oh, okay, not knowing at all what that meant exactly, how I was going to accomplish it. And I was talking to another friend of mine, and I said, Aisha, what have I gotten myself into? Now we've done all this work, and I don't know what to do. Now, you also have to remember, we didn't have computer in school when I was in school. Computer, home computers were just kind of coming on the scene. Not, you know, none of us, I knew how to type. I mean, when I went to typing in college, it was on your old manual typewriters.
What?
Okay.
You're lying.
Yes, I'm an old woman, girl.
Typewriter at Avatar?
Yes, yes. When I was in college, we used typewriters.
That is
so, yes, I didn't really know how to use a computer. So my friend Aisha pops up and says, well, you know, we know a brother, he owns a computer store. Let's talk to him and see if there's, you know, anything. Anyway, long story short, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless Abdurrahman Shah is his name, because he loaned me his computer. He got me a program that taught me how to typeset. That poor brother, over many years, I messed up so many things. I ended up buying a computer from him. And I kept messing things up because I didn't know what I was doing. And he kept having to face, just like, just don't touch stuff, you know, just use the programs. Don't try to get to the guts of the computer. But anyway, he had so much patience. Anyway, I really ended up being self-taught because of the help that Brother Abdurrahman gave me. And so I typeset the first book. I took it back to the publisher. You know, it wasn't perfect, but it was pretty good for a newbie. And after that, he just said, I would really like you guys to continue. And we did another of Abu Bilal's books that he had done. And as they say, the rest is history.
After succeeding publishing Ibn Qayyim's book for a bunch of amateurs, as she describes it, they continued to translate more of Abu Bilal's books to his publisher, Brother Sulaiman, who was the owner of the bookstore Dar al-Abu Qasim. At the time, she also recruited another American revert sister by the name of Mary Kennedy, because she had a knack in correcting pronunciation and grammar mistakes like a pro. And together, for a long time, they translated some of the most popular and respected Islamic books for the world, minimizing the gap of accessibility of classic Islamic literature by renowned scholars for the English-speaking world, which, by the way, wasn't as common back then, which is truly incredible, eh? These women were pioneers in the game. Imagine all the people these women have helped learn their deen that weren't native Arabic speakers, and barely anybody knew their names. So, out of curiosity, how did the name Sahih International come about? How'd you guys name yourselves?
It was a suggestion. We just couldn't think of anything. And so we were just kind of throwing names out there, and it's like, well, inshallah, everything's going to be sahih. You know, it's going to be correct, right?
Yep.
Authentic.
That's a good way to name it, you know, keep your motivations.
Right. And then the international came about simply because in the mid-1990s, I did make a contract with Suleiman that I was his sole distributor of his books in the U.S. and Canada.
Oh.
So people used to order directly from him from Jeddah and ship them over. And then at that time, no, I shipped everything over, and then people, bookstores here in America, had to order directly from me.
Okay.
And so, you know, we had already been publishing, right? You know, so the international just got tagged on there because hopefully the things would go internationally eventually. You know, I don't think there was too much thought about it. It's just we needed a name, and it was going to press, and so we had to put a name on there. Yeah. I mean, this is from the time of Abu Bilal's first book on the Nafs and Ruh. We, you know, it was said, edited and typeset by Sahih International.
Mm-hmm. Where and you mentioned before that women weren't allowed to, you know, have published companies, and they weren't allowed to even probably edit. So it made sense that for you guys to have an incognito name. Is that also, was it also to be able to do what you guys?
Well, it's not that you couldn't have a publishing company. Foreigners couldn't have a publishing company. I think there was only, if I was told that I was only the second woman in Saudi Arabia to ever get a license to publish.
Wow.
It's called Dar Nashr wa Tawzi'a, right? Whether that's exactly accurate, you know, don't hold me to it. That's what I was told.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's not that women couldn't do things. It just wasn't common yet,
mm-hmm.
right? A lot of things that women were doing at that time was behind closed doors. And believe me, there's women there who own factories and architectural firms and, you know, but it was all kind of behind the scenes. Saudi Arabia has changed drastically mm-hmm. since then mm-hmm. and everything's, you know, open. But in those days, women just were not out there. You know, they were teachers or doctors or things like that in the banks or something, but there wasn't a lot of women out in the public doing things. Like there were some times that I would sit in my store and people would be shocked that a woman was sitting behind the desk in a store. In those days. That was before women worked in grocery stores and, you know, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. There used to be Powerpuff Girls, Charlie's Angels, Destiny Child, famous girl groups. But I'm realizing there was someone before them. Sahih International. The girl group we didn't know we needed. At first, you know, they started their journey with translating Abu Bilal's books. It eventually carpooled into something much, much more. They also started working with Brother Suleiman more seriously, publishing for this bookstore locally and international. I mean, these people were superstars, superstars, real superstars, as well as for the Dawah Center in Muhammad Tara too. And then AJ gets this crazy idea, okay? She gets the craziest idea to translate the book, the best book on earth. The book that was sent to mankind as a mercy and guidance. Can you guess? The Quran. But to AJ's surprise, it wasn't the easiest project to get the girl group on board.
I knew with the limited Arabic that I have, I knew that she had the ability to make me comprehend things about Quran that I never got from previous translations. And I will give you one example, like the word awliya. In Yusuf Ali's translation back, you know, I've been a Muslim for over 30 years, so that's what I came into Islam with. He said, you know, do not take the non-believers as friends. That's how he translated awliya, as friends. But when we were in class with Umm Muhammad and she translated it as allies and explained, like, this is in a time of war, you can't go to the other side, you can't, you know, you have to trust and stick with your community and all of that. So it was the subtle meanings. As a new Muslim, I was ignorant. And when it said, don't take non-Muslims as friends, I took it very literally. Mm. And I started to think, oh my God, you know, do I have to give up my friends? and maybe that was naive. And maybe it was because I was just a young girl, you know, 19 years old, something like that. But I just, and there's so many other examples, you know, لَا تَأْخُذُهُ سِنَةٌ وَلَا نَوْمٌ. Don't take, in the old translations, it said, no slumber or sleep overtakes him. But if you look up the definitions in English of slumber and sleep, they literally mean the same thing, right? But sina in Arabic is that point where you're really, you're still aware of what's going around you, but you're super tired. There, we don't have a word in English actually for this, but the closest that Muhammad could think of was drowsiness. Mm. But again, the explanation, like I learned the subtleties in things that as best as you could in a second language, because nothing will ever compare to Arabic, right? Mm. So of course, learning from her and comprehending, I really wanted her to do a translation, and she was just like, no way, like, nobody's going to take us seriously. We're women, you know, foreign women living in Saudi Arabia, da-da-da-da-da. But we had been working for several years up to that time with a publisher, working as subcontractors to edit other authors who brought him things in English. So he was, Dar Abul Qasim was owned by a man named Suleiman Qasim. He was actually the first a publisher in Saudi Arabia to really concentrate on books in foreign languages, meaning, you know, of course, not Arabic, right? So Indonesian, English, Tagalog, you know, whatever. Even before Dar es Salaam really got big, he was the person like all of us went to as new Muslims to get books. And so we just started doing work for him. And I kept telling him, Muhammad has this amazing ability, you know, as a native English speaker, things had never been so concise and clear. And so I was trying to encourage her to do it, and she just won't do it. And it, I think it took us about 3 years to finally convince her. She had finally, even for her to even pray istikhara for the first time, because she just kept saying, no, 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 no. And after she prayed the istikhara, even though she had several volumes of tafsir, it turned out that somebody gifted her another set that she had always kind of wanted. And originally, we had thought that we would just take Halali and Khan's translation, which, of course, we know that they made a lot of improvements in Aqidah over, like, Yusuf Ali's, but their English was kind of lacking. Mm. They would put in a lot of definitions within the text that didn't necessarily fit within each of those ayahs, so it was kind of clumsy in places.
Yeah.
But we thought, okay, we can take the improvements they've done, and we'll just try to further improve it. But once we had gotten into that, we saw that it was actually more difficult to try to correct somebody's work than to just start over. Mm. So then I literally typed up the whole Quran, and then Muhammad ended up basically just rewriting the whole entire thing. So, you know, my job and Mary's job was to work as editors, and a lot of times I would say, Muhammad didn't want it to be a tafsir. Mm. She wanted it just to be translation. But we would keep saying, but we've got to put a footnote on this verse. Mm. This is a verse that people don't comprehend. They need a little more explanation. And she just was trying to resist. But there were times that I just said, no, I insist we have to say something about this verse, right? But at the same time, it also took us another 3 years to actually go through it numerous, numerous, numerous times. You do not want to, you know, yes, we're human beings, but we wanted to be on top of it as much as we possibly could. And so the first edition was published in 1997.
So in that journey, okay, I would assume the more responsibility would have gotten to you guys. If I was given the response, like, to work on this, I would, you know, like, naturally, I would be like, oh my God, what if I make a mistake? What if I, you know, harm the, you know, the book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, misinterpreted the wrong way? Was that at all, like, did it ever get to you guys where you're like, oh my God, what are we doing? Maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Was there ever a time where you got,
absolutely,
maybe your motivation, you know, because it's 6 years, motivation was, you know, maybe depleted? Like, what was that journey like?
I don't think the motivation ever depleted, honestly. I think there was so much barakah in it. There was so much enthusiasm about it. I think what was frustrating is that daily life got in the way. You know, Mary and I both had, Mary had small kids at that time. I just had a lot going on, you know, doing other projects. And, you know, Muhammad was teaching and, you know, had her family as well. And, you know, then again, like I said, just the living in that society at that time where it was hard to get together and do things, it was just the frustration of not being able to go faster. But yes, I mean, this is the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that you are trying to fairly put out, you know, and you don't want to make a mistake, and yet you know you're human and you know that you can. So it's a huge amount, but that's why you also have to really trust, especially in the early scholars, you know, and they're tafsirs. And you have to be careful with tafsir too, because there's tafsirs that have weak hadith, there's tafsir that have Israeliyat, you know, stories of you know, prior generations that were not Islamic. You have also people's personal opinions that get incorporated into that. So it's really necessary to be knowledgeable. If you don't have that knowledge to be able to go through tafsir and know that you cannot literally trust in everything that's mentioned there, but alhamdulillah, with the knowledge that Umm Muhammad had, based on studying all of those people, she was able to decipher through that.
Wow.
And the other thing is that something that happens is that people want to, you know, sometimes translators, especially there were Arabs sometimes who called and or wrote in and made suggestions and said, well, I looked up in the dictionary and I don't understand why you use that term or whatever. When the dictionary says, well, you cannot rely on modern standard Arabic to go back to the original tafsir. Some words have literally changed in meaning to be almost opposite of what they meant back then. You know, so having knowledge is absolutely the first step, not only in Arabic, but in the target language, in its English or whatever translation, whatever language you're going into. You have to know sometimes even just the way that people use things, right, in the daily usage. You can't rely on dictionaries.
Yeah, subhanAllah. Was there times where between you, Mary, and Muhammad, we had to remind each other, you know, like why you guys are doing this? Were there moments where you had to kind of like, you know, regroup, you know, when things were, you know, frustrating and hard?
I don't really feel like we struggled with that. Mm-hmm. We struggled more with debating about grammar and usage, because there was several intents. Umm Muhammad wanted to keep to the Arabic as much as possible, but then you start getting into some funny sounding English sometimes. You know, the construction of the two languages is so different. So how can we stay true to the Arabic, try to help students of Arabic to help them to be able to follow along, and yet make it pleasant to the English reader's sense, you know? That is the biggest challenge. Literally, we would have debates about, yeah, but the comma changes the meaning here to be such and such or such, you know. It was really technical. The difficulties were those technical issues,
yeah,
in language.
Yeah. When you guys finally, you know, did it and you were done, what was that like? The day you guys were like, we're done. It's sent to Brother Suleiman and he's going to do with it as he wishes. What was that day like?
I guess it was just kind of like, okay, bismillah, you know, and I don't think that we thought we were going to have to go back so many times and kind of have to review some things. Mm. Yeah, we probably thought, whew, we're done.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that simple. It wasn't that,
because you guys were always going to have to improve it, because it's something you guys started. So the errors and it's, I mean, like when you do something that is, you know, for sake of Allah ta'ala, and you're working, you know, with Allah's book, you're not just going to just think, okay, I'm done. You're going to try to revisit it. You're going to try to see if there's areas that you, you know, made mistaken. So I can imagine that it was a relationship that it was not ending, you know, like it was always going to continue. And the interesting part here is that when you guys published the first edition, your names were not on it. Nobody knew,
right,
that women translated this. I think we learned a lot about the way that men have contributed, you know, the way that men have participated in this deen. But to hear that women, especially three white American women, you know, who convert to Islam, had made this huge contribution. Because I've never told you this, but I'm telling you, your translation is a translation that made me really understand the Quran. Was you're the only translation I understood. I didn't like Yusuf Ali. I didn't like Muhsin. And then the Art Thou ones, I could not. Those are the ones I originally saw when I was rediscovering my faith. But it was your translation that really gave me the thirst of knowledge, because I could finally understand what Allah was saying to me, right?
I think we always looked at the work not as our project, mm-hmm. This was Allah's project, and Allah uses you. Mm. And if we just kept, if there was anything that we regrouped in, it was making the dua that we are doing this with the right niyyah, with the right intention, that this was for Allah, this was for the ummah, this was to share. That's where I always came from. This is why I wanted it, not because we wanted, you know, any kind of attention or recognition. Never. That's never what we wanted. That's why it was so hard to find us, because that we never wanted to speak about it, really. We just wanted the book to be out there and people to benefit, mm-hmm. right? So when you do something for the right niyyah, then Allah, inshallah, you know, inshallah, He really blessed it.
Abdullah, do you ever have moments where you think about potentially the amount of people that have accepted Islam because of the translations you guys did? Do you ever think about that? Do you ever think...
No.
Do you ever think about what this work could mean in the sight of Allah? Do you ever think about that? Like, or do you just like, I hope Allah accepts it? You know? Like, who knows, you know?
So Mary used to say to her kids when they would do good deeds when they were little, she'd say, cha-ching, like you just added something to your bank, you know, for Jenna. Mm. And I think sometimes that would kind of go in my head like, oh, inshallah, there's a cha-ching right no, there, right?
There's inshallah, a cha-ching.
Amatullah,
let me confirm
a little
with you,
deposit.
Absolutely a cha-ching. And I hope that Allah SWT accepts it from you, because it's a huge thing, because that was the thing that, because I don't speak Arabic, right? I'm learning Arabic, right? But I don't speak Arabic. You know, I grew up in the West. I'm as Canadian as Canadian can be, right? And so the English translation is what we need. It's the thing that we need before we get into the next level. And so whatever that is so detrimental to our understanding of Allah's book. Inshallah, I hope to learn Arabic so I don't have
but
to
I
be
wanna...
limited by it. But it's a starter. It's where we start.
Right.
You know, that's where we land. This is where
right,
our first
exactly.
entrance of the door is. This is where our thirst begins. This is where we get to understand Allah a little bit better. And then inshallah, our journey could do. It's the first door. It's the first door.
Right. For me, it was about the correctness. Because like I said, I struggled with some concepts in Islam when I first became mm-hmm. a Muslim, because they weren't presented in an understandable way because the translations were poor. And I think that having become a Muslim myself and struggled with that, when I met somebody that could make me understand properly, that's why I was so kind of gung-ho in we have to do this, right? But I also want to talk real. I mean, I can't have that project define who I am. That's not who I am. I am a human being that struggles. You know, people I used to, like people in Jeddah would find out who I quote unquote was. I mean, I'm nobody special. I'm just a person that happened to do that. That does not define me. And I used to really shy away and get embarrassed by that. I didn't ever want to be introduced as, oh, this is the owner of Sahih International, or, you know, because really in reality, my part of it is very minor. Muhammad is, if anybody deserves the credit for it, she's the one who was able to get that language, you know, out there, right? But I know myself. You can't have people look up to you as you're something special or you did something incredible when you're so much more complex than that one project that you happen to accomplish. You know, I struggle as a Muslim. Sometimes you hear these speakers out here and they've accomplished these great things, but we can't, I don't want to use the word idolize because that's wrong, but, you know what I mean?
No.
Like we look up
yeah,
to somebody like,
yeah.
oh, I can't reach that level. Mm-hmm. And I would just think, people, you don't know me. You don't know what hardships I've gone through. You don't know the trials that I've gone through. You don't know anything about me. You only know that I participated in this project. And that does not define me as a person or as a Muslim.
As the years passed, Brother Suleiman, the owner of Darul Qasim Bookstore, was getting older. And he eventually got really, really sick. He could no longer keep his store open anymore, and so he closed it down. Despite the fact that he was getting offers from others to inquire his store, he just didn't find someone he trusted would keep the da'wah going and the work sincere. And so he kept his bookstore closed, and he let the precious books collect dust. Until AJ made him an offer he couldn't refuse. Find out next week to hear the rest of Amitullah Bentley's story. If you thought part one was good, part two is going to make you shed tears you've never shed before. So get ready. This episode is brought to you by Beautiful Light Studios. I love to give a shout out because, you know, I say giving shout outs because I'm from Toronto, the six. I want to give a shout out to my producer, Melissa. I'm going to thank you for editing this episode and for being wonderful. Barakalafa, kiss, kiss, kisses. Special thanks to our sister producers, Hoya and Nima Haroon. Graphic designer, Sima, aka Sima Farah. And now I can say this with Sima. Sima, we're the keys, Sima Bima. Jazakallah khair for the graphic design. It is incredible. And I'd also love to give a shout out to our marketing extraordinaire, Sosan Abdullah. You know what it is, baby sis. Actually, I should call you big sis. My bad. But thank you guys all for your hard work. If this podcast gave you any value, we're leaving it up to you this year. Donate however much you feel like it gave to you. We have a big team who put so many hours into bringing the show to life. If you can't give right now, that's fine. Just keep us in your drawers. That's enough. I'll see you guys next week in your ears, in your speakers, telling you what? Telling you a good story.